With Christmas being, as it so very often is, a time that is both personal and shared, it's a true joy for WGTE to celebrate this day with you on the FM 91 airwaves. These airwaves that have a way of likewise reaching you individually, even while linking us together through a widespread community of listeners. I'm Mary Claire Murphy, your host for the 2025 edition of WGTE's locally produced Seasons Readings from FM 91. Our first chapter of tales is a gallery of holiday anecdotes that were submitted to WGTE directly from members of this FM 91 listening community. There are memorable moments happening all around us, and these might just put a smile on your face and tug at the heartstrings. Joan Calicott of Bowling Green, Ohio, stopped by our studio to share with us these fond childhood memories of holidays in Chicago.
Growing up in Chicago in the mid-20th century, the holiday season was launched by taking the L, an elevated train that morphs into a subway, into downtown Chicago, where we would join the crowds to admire the fascinating window dressings at Marshall Field & Company, now Macy's. Viewers young and old oohed and aahed at the fanciful scenes. There were 8 to 10 windows along State Street. At one display, you could almost smell the cookies baking in the cozy kitchen. Another allowed you to peek in to see the contents of a package. The toys were more exciting than the clothes. Another window depicted Clement Moore's Night Before Christmas Santa flying through the sky with his reindeers, calling out, "Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen." Of course, with red-nosed Rudolph leading the way. One window would show lumberjacks harvesting Christmas trees and loading them onto trucks. Another window depicted a family decorating the Christmas tree, hanging their stockings on the mantle while the fire in the fireplace almost warmed up the viewers. Of course, Santa coming down the chimney with his satchel of goodies was a favorite. Even though it was usually very cold, everyone took their time to absorb the scenes. When satiated with the window displays, we would ride the escalator up to the Walnut Dining Room on the 7th floor and try to get a table as close as possible to the 30 to 40 foot lavishly decorated Christmas tree. The meal was definitely secondary to the tree. Lunch was followed by the much anticipated visit to Old St. Nick, of course. Elves were all about distracting the children waiting their chance to get onto Santa's lap. We staunchly kept secret our request to Santa, having great faith in him. Leaving Marshall Field in downtown Chicago, we drove along Lake Michigan, fascinated by the wind-driven waves pounding the shore, on our way to our second special place, a visit to the Museum of Science and Industry and its spectacular Christmas Around the World and Holidays of Light exhibit. Chicago families and organizations representing 57 countries, as diverse as Mexico, Germany, and Japan, to name a few, come to the museum each year to decorate their country's Christmas tree. They research how their country celebrates Christmas in terms of illuminations, decorations, food, and traditions. Each country installs a display of their unique and overall charming traditions on how they celebrate Christmas. At the museum, we were excited to take an escalator to the next floor where we could look down on all the trees which surrounded the huge 25 yards by 75 yards enclosed panorama of trains moving through various urban and rural areas with many moving displays. While at the museum, of course, we had to be lowered down by a cage elevator to the authentic working coal mine and sit in a caged small railroad car through the myriad of tunnels. As a child, I was always fascinated by the Museum of Science and Industry displays, especially the Christmas Around the World display. When a teenager, my father became the business manager of the museum. Then I, and later our children and grandchildren, received very special service and treatment at the museum. Our daughters renamed it Grandpa's Museum. As much as I enjoyed these special holiday events, it has been such a thrill to have been able to share the experiences with our daughters and grandchildren, and hope they can continue sharing them with generations to come.
For WGTE's Seasons Readings of Stories from the Community, Joan Callicott submitted and voiced her fond memories of holidays in Chicago. On the note of Christmas through generations, we turn next to a holiday entry by Teresa Pfeiffer, as narrated by her grandson Logan Cooney.
Christmas has always been very special to me, so much so that I poked and prodded my mother so I would be born on Christmas Eve. I just couldn't wait another year to celebrate Christmas. My three brothers, however, did not like the idea of their mother having to go to the hospital before Santa came. Mom always helped Santa arrange the gifts under the tree, but I was persistent, and around 6 p.m., I popped out. Dad had to be Santa's helper that year. He didn't mind. In fact, he was delighted that his first little girl was born on Christmas Eve. She joined his mother and sister to celebrate their birthdays on the same day. Three generations of Christmas Eve babies. Dad's mother, sister, and daughter all born on the holiday. It was his claim to fame. I heard that when he got home from the hospital that evening, he and Santa raised their glasses and said, "We'll drink to that." We as a family are still honoring Dad's celebration as we gather at my daughter's home on Christmas Eve and raise our glasses to the birthday girls and honor our family's Christmas stories, some sublime and some ridiculous. Hey everyone, this is Logan Cooney, producer and host here at FM 91. This story was submitted by my grandma, Teresa Pfeiffer, whose birthday, as you heard, is on Christmas Eve. You know, one of my fondest memories of the holiday season growing up is of our Christmas Eve parties with family and friends. Lots of celebration going on that night, of course, but during the night, we always took the time to wish my grandma a happy birthday. Really, several birthdays in one night, you could say. It was a real honor to present this story to all of you. Remember to always appreciate your time with loved ones. On behalf of myself and everyone here at FM 91, have a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
It's Seasons Readings from FM 91, and I'm your host, Mary Claire Murphy at WGTE. Here at the station, we are all wishing you all the joy your heart can hold, but we're also with you in spirit if this season is one that, for any reason, moves you to tears. I hope you might let this next story wrap you with the warmth of a hug. That said, we'd like to thank Kimberly Kaufman of Oak Harbor, Ohio, for sharing this reflection on Reggie's Tree Topper.
Friends who visit our home this holiday season may be intrigued, even a little confused, about the topper on our Christmas tree. An old plastic tree topper might seem a bit out of place atop a homespun Christmas tree, adorned in simple handmade ornaments. But there's so much more to it than a simple tree topper. This is a finial perched atop a child's holiday memories, a lightning rod that conducted the best energies of a father who was hard on his family. Its presence and its meaning protecting them from the things that were hard to understand. My mother absolutely loved Christmas. When we were kids, she insisted on having a live tree to decorate. As a kid, I had no idea how the tree got there. It just sort of magically appeared. I know now that Mom and Dad would have quite a row every year about buying the tree, getting it into the house, and positioning it just so. My dad was hard on us, and there were times when it wasn't always clear whether he loved us or just tolerated us. He was a mechanic and a farmer, hardworking but with a silly streak and with an abundance of friends. He loved racing. Cars, motorcycles, snowmobiles. If it had wheels, he could make it go faster. And his garage was always filled with all of his buddies. But with five kids, lean times, and more challenges than a child could begin to comprehend, he was demanding of his kids, sometimes downright harsh, and he almost always repressed any kind of emotion in our company. I often wondered what it was that made Dad so unhappy. It wasn't until I was a grown-up that I could truly appreciate the challenges he faced, how hard the man worked, and his struggles to keep food in our mouths and a roof over our heads. I grew to know and understand that his love for us was a powerful force in his life. He just struggled to express it. So as a child, I clung to the few things that brought out the best in him. The happy, silly, fun dad that made me want to jump into his arms and beg him to always smile that smile that seemed to come straight from his heart. Things like his Christmas tree topper. My mother and I, along with my four brothers and sisters, Laura, Tina, Tony, and Aaron, decorated the tree. Dad didn't participate in any way until the very end. And then he would root through the post-tree decorating chaos until he found his tree topper, and holding it above his head like a scepter, would proudly declare that it wasn't a Christmas tree until his topper was on top. And every year, Mom would playfully object, "But Reg, that thing is so old and nasty." And it really was. "Why don't we get a new one this year?" And oh, how he would rant. "There's not a darn thing wrong with this one," he would exclaim. Even though the finish had worn off, both of the side pieces that held the little bells had long since broken off, and the wire that lit up the bulb in the middle of the angel hair center had shorted out. To be honest, it looked like something he had dug out of the trash. I remember once my mom tried to buy a lovely new angel and just quietly replace Dad's topper on the tree. He hadn't been in the house but a minute before he noticed the switch, and he immediately went digging for that old, broken, decrepit, amazing, beautiful, perfect topper. In later years, Dad mellowed into the most loving father and grandfather we could have ever hoped for. He's been gone for more than 15 years now, and I never miss him more than I do at Christmas. When he died, my oldest sister Laura took loving possession of Dad's tree topper, preserving that broken mess of beautiful memories, cherishing it for the treasure that it is. Last Christmas, on a whim, without telling us, my sister Tina Googled vintage Christmas tree toppers, and lo and behold, she discovered an eBay auction that had several of these vintage treasures for sale. They were nearly identical to Dad's, and she gave them to us with no warning last Christmas. When I opened that box, well, I still can't think about it without crying. And so this year, the first of what I hope will be many, our tree is adorned with Reggie's tree topper. And if there is an afterlife, I know that Dad is looking down at me with that twinkle in his eye, smiling his best dad smile.
Some moments you just never forget. That was one of them for Kimberly Kaufman of Oak Harbor, Ohio, who submitted and narrated her reflection on Reggie's tree topper for Seasons Readings from FM 91. We'll close our chapter of community stories with an ode to the winter wild cards that were dealt occasionally here in the Great Lakes region. In particular, Jim Mollenkopf of Toledo, Ohio, takes us back to the incredibly cold Christmas of 1983, or the year the beer froze. Jim's story is narrated here by WGTE's Assistant Chief Engineer Derek Strelow.
Perhaps expectations for weather going into Christmas of 1983 were unreasonably optimistic, since the previous Christmas had been one of record warmth, with temperatures in the 60s and heavy rain. But the Arctic air mass that moved into Ohio a few days before the Yule disabused area residents of that. The temperature began a steady plunge, and Christmas Eve morning broke, with the Toledo temperature at a record-shattering minus 15 degrees, with a strong breeze to go along with it. On what would normally be a big travel day, car batteries were dead, and jumper cables were the order of the day, stretching between open hoods like giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Travel in the rural areas was not advised, with Arctic winds whipping clouds of powdery snow across highways and into drifts. My wife and I were scheduled to drive to her family's house in rural Williams County and, not relishing the idea of sliding into a ditch, I suggested that we could skip her family this year. Her icy glare ended that thought. We headed west on US 20, the high that day only reaching minus 6, with fingers crossed and extra blankets and sweaters piled in the back. It was a surreal drive, with few people outside and clouds of snow blowing across frozen fields, at times obscuring the cold sun before all was clear, and the sky arctic blue again. There was a harsh beauty to it, which we admired until we hit an icy patch and nearly spun out, but we arrived in our hometown of Pioneer safely. The look on her parents' eyes when we arrived made the drive worth it, especially as some other out-of-town family members were unable to make it. Her father ran a garage in town and had been up before dawn helping people get their cars started. We didn't stay as long as usual, wanting to head back while there was still some daylight. The lights of Christmas trees, shining through frosted windows in homes along the way, were twinkling and translucent, while outside lights danced in the polar breeze. As daylight ebbed, a nearly full moon rose in the east before shining on a long, cold, and most silent of nights. The next morning, Christmas morning, dawned a bit warmer with the temperature at minus 13. Again, it was another round of cars groaning to a start, and people bundled up and heading for Christmas morning services or to spend the day with loved ones. At my parents' house, expectations were high, as my sister and her husband coming from the east would be bringing their first child and my folks' first grandchild. But with heavy lake effect snow on their path, concern also ran high, and there were no cell phones back then to check their progress. Morning turned into afternoon, and anxiety gave way to joy when their icy car finally pulled into the driveway. There was much ooing and aahing and waiting of turns to hold the new baby, and now the celebration could begin. There was beer and bottles stored in a nice chest in the attached and semi-heated garage, but to our astonishment and disappointment, the contents of every bottle, all 12 of them, had frozen solid, bursting the glass into pieces. Though it was a Christmas of adversity, with biting winds and record cold temperatures that still stand, it became a memorable one for that reason. It was one of determination to celebrate this most important of holidays, despite the challenges of neighbors helping neighbors, of motorists pulling over to check on stalled vehicles, and of an esprit de corps that we're all going to get through this together, and one that was talked about 4 years after.
Jim Mollenkopf of Toledo, Ohio, authored that tale of the incredibly cold Christmas of 1983, or the year the beer froze. And Derek Strelo narrated in that last parcel of holiday happenings as submitted by community members for Seasons Readings from FM 91. Our next chapter of readings taps into a handful of festive literature, each one a bite-sized delight, or a whole helping in the case of The Tailor of Gloucester by Beatrix Potter. WGTE's Morning Edition host, Kari Marshall, joins us here for the telling.
In the time of swords and periwigs, and full-skirted coats with flowered lappets, when gentlemen wore ruffles and gold-laced waistcoats of paduasoy and taffeta, there lived a tailor in Gloucester. He sat in the window of a little shop in Westgate Street, cross-legged on a table from morning till dark. All day long while the light lasted, he sewed and snippeted, piecing out his satin and pompadour and lutestring. Stuffs had strange names and were very expensive in the days of the Tailor of Gloucester. But although he sewed fine silk for his neighbors, he himself was very, very poor. A little old man in spectacles, with a pinched face, old crooked fingers, and a suit of threadbare clothes. He cut his coats without waste, according to his embroidered cloth. They were very small ends and snippets that lay about upon the table.
"Two narrow breadths for naught, except waistcoats for mice," said the tailor.
One bitter cold day near Christmas time, the tailor began to make a coat of cherry-colored corded silk, embroidered with pansies and roses, and a cream-colored satin waistcoat trimmed with gauze and green worsted Chanel for the mayor of Gloucester. The tailor worked and worked, and he talked to himself. He measured the silk and turned it round and round and trimmed it into shape with his shears. The table was all littered with cherry-colored snippets.
No breadth at all, and cut on the cross, it's no breadth at all. Tippets for mice, and ribbons for mobs, for mice, said the tailor of Gloucester.
When the snowflakes came down against the small leaded window panes and shut out the light, the tailor had done his day's work. All the silk and satin lay cut out upon the table. There were 12 pieces for the coat and 4 pieces for the waistcoat, and there were pocket flaps and cuffs and buttons all in order. For the lining of the coat, there was fine yellow taffeta, and for the buttonholes of the waistcoat, there was cherry-colored twist. And everything was ready to sew together in the morning, all measured and sufficient, except there was wanting just one single skein of cherry-colored twisted silk. The tailor came out of his shop at dark, for he did not sleep there at nights. He fastened the window and locked the door, and took away the key. No one lived there at night but little brown mice, and they run in and out without any keys. For behind the wooden wainscots of all the old houses in Gloucester, there are little mouse staircases and secret trap doors, and the mice run from house to house through those long, narrow passages. They can run all over the town without going into the streets. But the tailor came out of his shop and shuffled home through the snow. He lived quite nearby in College Court, next to the doorway to College Green. And although it was not a big house, the tailor was so poor, he only rented the kitchen. He lived alone with his cat. It was called Simkin. Now all day long, while the tailor was out at work, Simkin kept the house by himself. And he also was fond of the mice, though he gave them no satin for coats. Said the cat when the tailor opened the door. The tailor replied,
Simkin, we shall make our fortune, but I am worn to a raveling. Take this groat, which is our last fourpence, and Simkin, take a china pimpkin. Buy a pennyworth of bread, a pennyworth of milk, and a pennyworth of sausages. And oh, Simkin, with the last penny of our fourpence, buy me one pennyworth of cherry-coloured silk. But do not lose the last penny of the fourpence, Simkin, or I am undone and worn to thread paper, for I have no more twist.
Then Simkin again said, and took the groat and the pipkin and went out into the dark. The tailor was very tired and beginning to be ill. He sat down by the hearth and talked to himself about that wonderful coat.
I shall make my fortune to be cut bias. The mayor of Gloucester is to be married on Christmas Day in the morning, and he hath ordered a coat and an embroidered waistcoat to be lined with yellow taffeta, and the taffeta sufficeth. There is no more left over in the snippets than will serve to make tippets for mice.
Then the tailor started, for suddenly, interrupting him, from the dresser at the other side of the kitchen came a number of little noises.
Now what can that be?
Said the tailor of Gloucester, jumping up from his chair. The dresser was covered with crockery and pipkins, willow pattern plates and teacups and mugs. The tailor crossed the kitchen and stood quite still beside the dresser, listening and peering through his spectacles. Again, from under the teacup came those funny little noises.
This is very peculiar, said the tailor of Gloucester.
and he lifted up the teacup, which was upside down. Out stepped a little live lady mouse and made a curtsy to the tailor. Then she hopped away down off the dresser and under the wainscot. The tailor sat down again by the fire, warming his poor cold hands and mumbling to himself,
"The waistcoat is cut out from peach-colored satin, tambour stitch and rose buds in beautiful floss silk. Was I wise to entrust my last fourpence to Simkin, 1 in 20 buttonholes of cherry-colored twist?"
But all at once, from the dresser, there came other little noises.
"This is passing extraordinary," said the tailor of Gloucester, and turned over another teacup, which was upside down.
Out stepped a little gentleman mouse, and made a bow to the tailor. And then, from all over the dresser came a chorus of little tappings, all sounding together and answering one another, like watch beetles in an old worm-eaten window shutter. And out from under teacups, and from under bowls and basins, stepped other and more little mice who hopped away down off the dresser and under the wainscot. The tailor sat down, close over the fire, lamenting,
1 and 20 buttonholes of cherry-coloured silk to be finished by noon of Saturday, and this is Tuesday evening. Was it right to let loose those mice? Undoubtedly, the property of Simkin. Alack, I am undone, for I have no more twist."
The little mice came out again and listened to the tailor. They took notice of the pattern of that wonderful coat. They whispered to one another about the taffeta lining and about little mouse tippets. And then all at once they all ran away together down the passage behind the wainscot, squeaking and calling to one another as they ran from house to house. And not one mouse was left in the tailor's kitchen when Simkin came back with a pipkin of milk. Simkin opened the door and bounced in with an angry like a cat that is vexed, for he hated the snow, and there was snow in his ears and snow in his collar at the back of his neck. He put down the loaf and the sausages upon the dresser and sniffed.
"Simkin," said the tailor, "where is my twist?"
But Simkin set down the pipkin of milk upon the dresser and looked suspiciously at the teacups. He wanted his supper of little fat mouse.
"Simkin," said the tailor, "where is my twist?"
But Simkin hid a little parcel privately in the teapot, and spit and growled at the tailor. And if Simkin had been able to talk, he would have asked, "Where is my mouse?"
"Alack, I am undone,"
said the tailor of Gloucester, and went sadly to bed. All that night long, Simkin hunted and searched throughout the kitchen, peeping into cupboards and under the wainscot, and into the teapot where he had hidden that twist. But still, he found never a mouse. Whenever the tailor muttered and talked in his sleep, Simkin said, and made strange, horrid noises, as cats do at night. For the poor old tailor was very ill with fever, tossing and turning in his four-post bed. And still, in his dreams, he mumbled,
"No more twist, no more twist."
All that day he was ill, and the next day, and the next. And what should become of the cherry-colored coat? In the tailor's shop in Westgate Street, the embroidered silk and satin lay cut out upon the table, 1 in 20 buttonholes, and who should come to sew them when the window was barred and the door was fast locked? But that does not hinder the little brown mice, They run in and out without any keys through all the old houses in Gloucester. Out of doors, the market folks went trudging through the snow to buy their geese and turkeys and bake their Christmas pies. But there would be no Christmas dinner for Simkin and the poor old tailor of Gloucester. The tailor lay ill for 3 days and nights, and then it was Christmas Eve, and very late at night. The moon climbed up over the roofs and chimneys and looked down over the gateway into College Court. There were no lights in the windows, nor any sound in the houses. All the city of Gloucester was fast asleep under the snow. And still, Simkin wanted his mice, and he mewed as he stood beside the four-post bed. But it is in the old story that all the beasts can talk in the night between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day in the morning, though there are very few folk that can hear them or know what it is they say. When the cathedral clock struck 12, there was an answer, like an echo of the chimes, and Simkin heard it, and came out of the tailor's door and wandered about in the snow. From all the roofs and gables and old wooden houses in Gloucester came a thousand merry voices singing the old Christmas rhymes. First and loudest, the cocks cried, "Dame, get up and bake your pies!" "Oh, dilly, dilly, dilly," sighed Simkin. And now in a garret there were lights and sounds of dancing, and cats came from over the way. "Hey, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle, all the cats in Gloucester except me," said Simkin. Under the wooden eaves, the starlings and sparrows sang of Christmas pies. The jackdaws woke up in the cathedral tower, and although it was in the middle of the night, the throstles and robins sang. The air was quite full of little twittering tunes. But it was all rather provoking to poor hungry Simkin. From the tailor's shop in Westgate came a glow of light, and when Simkin crept to peep in at the window, it was full of candles. There was a snippeting of scissors and a snappeting of thread, and little mouse voices sang loudly and gaily. Interrupted Simkin, and he scratched at the door, but the key was under the tailor's pillow. He could not get in. The little mice only laughed and tried another tune. Cried Simkin. "Hey, diddle dinkity," answered the little mice. They clicked their thimbles to mark the time, but none of the songs pleased Simkin. He sniffed and mewed at the door of the shop. Scuffled Simkin on the windowsill, while the little mice inside sprang to their feet and all began to shout at once in little twittering voices, "No more twist! No more twist!" And they barred up the window shutters and shut out Simkin. But still through the nicks in the shutters, he could hear the click of thimbles and little mouse voices singing, "No more twist! No more twist!" Simkin came away from the shop and went home, considering in his mind. He found the poor old tailor without fever, sleeping peacefully. Then Simkin went on tiptoe and took a little parcel of silk out of the teapot and looked at it in the moonlight, and he felt quite ashamed of his badness compared with those good little mice. When the tailor awoke in the morning, the first thing which he saw upon the patchwork quilt was a skein of cherry-colored twisted silk, and beside his bed stood the repentant Simkin.
"Alack, I am worn to a raveling," said the tailor of Gloucester. "But I have my twist."
The sun was shining on the snow when the tailor got up and dressed and came out into the street with Simkin running before him. The starlings whistled on the chimney stacks and the throstles and robins sang, but they sang their own little noises, not the words they had sung in the night.
"Alack," said the tailor, "I have my twist, but no more strength nor time than will serve to make me one single buttonhole. For this is Christmas Day in the morning. The mayor of Gloucester shall be married by noon, And where is this cherry-colored coat?
He unlocked the door of the little shop in Westgate Street, and Simkin ran in, like a cat that expects something. But there was no one there. Not even one little brown mouse. The boards were swept clean. The little ends of thread and the little silk snippets were all tidied away and gone from off the floor. But upon the table, oh joy! The tailor gave a shout. There, where he had left plain cuttings of silk, there lay the most beautifulest coat, an embroidered satin waistcoat that ever were worn by a mayor of Gloucester. There were roses and pansies upon the facings of the coat, and the waistcoat was worked with poppies and cornflowers. Everything was finished except just one single cherry-colored buttonhole, and where that buttonhole was wanting, there was pinned a scrap of paper with these words, in teeny-weeny writing. No more twist. And from then began the luck of the tailor of Gloucester. He grew quite stout, and he grew quite rich. He made the most wonderful waistcoats for all the rich merchants of Gloucester, and for the fine gentlemen of the country round. Never were seen such ruffles, or such embroidered cuffs and lappets. But his buttonholes were the greatest triumph of all. The stitches of those buttonholes were so neat, so neat. I wonder how they could be stitched by an old man in spectacles, with crooked old fingers and a tailor's thimble. The stitches of those buttonholes were so small, they looked as if they had been made by little mice.
As we leave the tailor of Gloucester to his golden years, an eager traveler all the while finds her own reward through trust. This is Maud Lindsay's tale of The Lions in the Way from The Storyteller on Seasons Readings from FM 91. Once upon a time, three friends set out to go to the palace of the king, which was known as the House Beautiful. The king himself had invited them there, and that they might have no trouble in finding the way, he sent to them a scroll upon which the path was marked so plainly that it would have been a hard matter to have missed it. And to make assurance doubly sure, he wrote upon the scroll with his own hand, bidding them to keep the path.
"Turn neither to the right nor to the left,"
his message said,
"but follow the path, and it will lead you safely to the House Beautiful, where I have prepared a place for you."
All their lives, the three friends had heard of the wonders of the king's house. Some people said that it was built of gold, bright as the sun itself. And others, that it was made of gleaming pearl. Its windows were said to overlook the whole world and its towers to reach higher than the sky. And everyone agreed that there was not within its gates but peace and joy. So eager were the friends to see it that they could not journey fast enough to satisfy themselves, and from morning until night they urged each other on. The path by which they were to go was a narrow path, with a rough place now and then a briar or a sharp stone upon it, but for the most part, it was a pleasant way. The travelers hastened joyfully along it, and all went well with them, until one day, they met a man whose face was turned towards the land from which they had just come.
"Good neighbors,"
he cried.
"Why travel you so fast? Is a house afire or a friend ill? Or does a feast wait till you come? Tell me, I pray you, that I may sorrow with you or rejoice as your need may be."
"Oh, rejoice, rejoice," cried the three, "for we journey to the king's house beautiful, where a place is prepared for us." But when the man heard this, he shook his head sorrowfully, as if what they told him was grievous news indeed.
"I, too, had thought of going there, but that was before I knew of the lions in the way."
"Lions in the way?" cried the travelers, looking at each other with startled eyes.
"Aye, lions,"
repeated the man solemnly.
"The fiercest and largest that man ever saw. Their very roaring shakes the ground, and many a traveler have been devoured by them." "As for myself, I have not seen them. To hear of them is enough for me."
"And for me,"
said one of the travelers, and in spite of all her companions might do or say to persuade her, she would go no farther.
"The king's house may be as beautiful as the morning, and as full of wonders as the sky is full of stars. But what good will it be to me if I'm eaten by lions?"
said she, and her friends were forced to journey on without her. As they went, they talked of the lions in the way, and one said to the other,
"Think you it is true, or but an idle tale?"
"True or not, we shall pass in safety. Have we not the king's own word for it?"
said the other, and she led the way with such great strides that her friend could scarcely keep pace with her. On and on they traveled, without stop or hindrance, till all at once the air was filled with a great noise that shook the earth beneath their feet and set their knees to trembling. There was no mistaking what it was. Even though they had never heard the sound before, they knew it was the roaring of lions. And the second traveler began to grow afraid.
"Let us go around by another way. Surely there are more paths than one to the king's house."
And though the other spread out before her the scroll on which the path was marked and read once more the message of the king,
"Turn neither to the right nor to the left, but follow the path, and it will lead you safely to the house beautiful, where I have prepared a place for you."
She would pay no heed to it, but turned away into a bypath and followed it out of sight. The other traveler was forced to journey on the path alone, with the roaring of lions in her ears and the shaking of the earth beneath her feet. Nor had she gone a furlong more when just ahead she spied the lions themselves, one on each side of the path. They stood with flaming eyes and yawning mouths, and at the very sight of them the traveler's heart beat quick and sharp, and her feet faltered upon the way. But her faith in the king's word was greater than her fear.
"Oh, falter not, O feet! Fear not, O heart! There's safety in the path. There has to be. The king himself has said it,"
she cried, and she pressed on. And lo and behold, when she came to the lions, she found that they were chained. Roar as they might, and strive as they would, they could not touch those who walked in the path that the king had marked. And the traveler passed in safety. Beyond the lions stood the house beautiful, with walls of gold bright as the sun itself, and gates of gleaming pearl. Its windows overlooked the world, its towers reached above the sky, and of its wonders, not the half had ever been told her. The traveler's place was prepared for her, and the king was waiting to welcome her to his house. And so she lived there, in peace and joy forever after. From FM91, may this Christmas day be filled with all the wonders, the peace, and the joy befitting this holiday season. And thanks for joining WGTE in Season's Readings from FM91, now concluded after that excerpt of The Storyteller by Maud Lindsay. I'm Mary Claire Murphy, wishing you a very Merry Christmas. Wherever you might call home, we're so grateful that you're part of this listening community, which is made possible with the support of listeners like you. Thank you. Thank you.